The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This episode of Retronauts is brought to you by the power of the printed word.
This week in Retronauts, that's what I expected. Hello, welcome back to Retronauts, and welcome back to the world of Marvel and Capcom, and Marvel versus Capcom. That's right, we're doing a follow-up to episode 608, which was just a few months ago, but so much has changed since then. Back then, in the, well, the wistful days of early 2024, we wondered what could happen if Capcom actually went back to its archives and drug out all these licensed games from the 90s and let people play them for a change. And Capcom did. Did they hear us? Did they make our dreams come true? I don't know. But what's more important is, it's out there. They've released it already. They worked fast. So here we are today, talking about Marvel vs. Capcom, the actual Marvel vs. Capcom games, as opposed to last time, where we walked up to the edge, and then stopped. But today, we're giving you that full release, word choice, of Marvel Capcom content. Excellent. I'm your host, Diamond Fight. I'm not taking anyone for a ride today. Do not ask me for a ride today. Joining me in the great state of Ohio.
Hi, I'm John Lerdon, and I almost had a heart attack there.
Oh, calm thyself. And joining me in Maryland?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Hi, this is Kevin Bunch, and my ROM infinites are awful.
Oh. Shout out to the ROM infinite.
Yes, well, we're going to say the word infinite a lot during this podcast, because let's face it, we're talking about Marvel Capcom games, and a lot of characters have the power to punch or kick or bunt you into infinity. That's just what they do.
It's what we love about the series, truly.
Well, as I believe we talked about last time, when one of these games is not broken enough, like it has some infinites but only a few, I believe our panel agreed that that was undesirable. We want more infinites, not less.
More broken, more better.
Okay, all right. I don't want to put anyone
last.
All right, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth. Okay, as long as we get consensus on that. So anyway, as I said, go back to 608 if you want to hear the run up to all this stuff, because I know there's a lot of backstory, but we did the backstory in a whole other podcast. Please enjoy that one. Let's start off in 1998, a very good year, with Marvel vs. Capcom: Clash of Superheroes. And John, I'll give credit to you. You want to point out, so yeah, 1998. What's Marvel doing in 1998? I feel like they're a light in the tunnel, right? Things are looking up a little bit?
No, the opposite is happening for Marvel. Like, the worst of the worst is going on here.
I'm sorry.
This podcast is going to be very interesting in that, like, with every game that we go through, it's going to be fun to sort of map the trajectory of Marvel's fortunes, because they were really careening toward bad, bad times. If you previously on Retronauts, it was a really kind of strange power difference between Capcom and Marvel at that point, because Marvel was starting to kind of go through bad times as the collapse of the comic shop industry and the speculator market kind of boomed within comics. That really rippled out to the big two, Marvel and DC, in weird ways, but DC was and is still owned by Warner Brothers and has been for decades. So even though they weren't doing great, they still had that parachute of like a huge corporate backer behind them, whereas Marvel was just sort of Marvel. You know, they were on their own, even though that they were the bigger of the players in the game. But they had made some bad deals, and a lot of the non-comics branding stuff, just, you know, the animated series and things were doing fine, but that wasn't really enough to kind of keep the lights on. So the writing was on the wall. So by 98, Capcom was starting to sort of slide a little bit, especially at least the Street Fighter franchise was not in a very good place, but they were still sort of doing better than Marvel. That was like barreling toward bankruptcy, which is something that we're going to talk about again in a second too. So really both of these brands were not in a great state when Marvel versus Capcom 1 came out in 1998. We're still a couple years away from the Fox X-Men movie, which will change the fortunes of a lot of these games. Actually, the success of those movies and being owned in perpetuity by 20th Century Fox at the time is going to play into a lot of this conversation. Yes. But in 1998, if anything, both companies were starting to really feel the pinch financially. And in Marvel's case, things weren't looking good at all.
Yeah, Capcom really had, at this point, they were falling back on Resident Evil to sort of shore up their fortunes, because they just got decimated by all the problems that were going on in the game industry in the mid-90s. You know, you had all sorts of new technologies that they had to struggle to keep up with. You had the Japanese recession, and suddenly you had a very strong yen, which meant that they couldn't make up their losses domestically, internationally very well. Like John said, Street Fighter, fighting games in general, like they sort of fell off of the zeitgeist in the mid-90s, like 95, 96. So they had various factors working against them, but they had Resident Evil to keep them alive. And I think that's probably why they were in better shape than Marvel at this point. Otherwise, they both would have really been flailing.
Yeah, and if it's 1998, that means Resident Evil 2 just came out after a lengthy delay. So during that delay, Capcom was very, But after the delay, you know, after the game came out, they sold 5 million copies, Capcom was very, hey. So they were definitely feeling the love at that point. By the time this game comes out.
And we're still a year away from a Dreamcast and 2 years away from a PlayStation 2. So, like, everyone is really sort of looking forward to what that next generation is going to be. And in Capcom's case, anyway, like, there was a pretty good refresh on their end for a lot of their brands, and like, this is pre-Devil May Cry. Things were in a very weird place in the video game industry, period, because we were in that sort of like really high moment of like, okay, Final Fantasy VII did really well on the PlayStation 1, but arcades are not what they were in America, so the PlayStation 1 is doing very well, but we're like, the industry is already sort of looking ahead to what that next step is going to be, and yeah, with arcade games being in the state that they were in, Street Fighter III New Generation did really badly for Capcom. That was a pretty big flop for them. Alpha 3 was that in 99? Was that 98?
Alpha 3 was 98, I think.
98?
And yes. Yeah, that was not,
98, yeah.
That was not really a big hit in arcades, at least in the U.S. It wasn't a flop like New Generation was, but I don't recall it, you know, being hugely popular until it came out on console.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're in a weird period. That's what we're getting.
Yeah.
And just an addendum, John, as you mentioned, Dreamcast is out in Japan by year's end. Mm. So Dreamcast is late 98 in Japan. Big, you know, the 99 release in America, of course, is a big deal. But that means by this point, 1988, Capcom is already looking at, if not actively making, Dreamcast games and figuring out what they can do for Dreamcast. I'm sure at some point, they're deciding, oh, geez, do we want a Resident Evil on the Dreamcast? Which one do we want? Is it a new game? You know, because, you know, 2 just came out. Like, okay, well, 2 sold bangers. And I think by year's end, they greenlight like 5 different Resident Evil games. So certainly one of them ends up being Code Veronica. So
it was a very Capcom move. This one works. Make tons of them.
Yes.
Hey, it worked for Mega Man, right? Until it didn't.
Works for Street Fighter until I didn't.
But anyway, here in arcades, never mind the home consoles for now, here in arcades, on the CPS System 2, we have Marvel Capcom 2, and we have Alpha 3. I think they're both, pretty sure they're both 98. And what I like about this is they've finally given up on the whole specificity thing. It's like, okay, we don't need X-Men, we don't need superheroes, we don't need Street Fighter. It is just, here is the Marvel company, here is the Capcom company, here are our toys, let's bang them together. Just go for it, man. And it I think it works. I think it worked, like, for me, like, when I saw it in arcades, it's like, oh, yes, yes, this is what I want, absolutely. Yes, give me, here are my coins, please, take my money.
Yeah, throwing Mega Man in the roster, which, you know, we should talk about the roster at some point, really sold this on me when I first experienced it, and I think it was 99, actually. I think the first time I played this was the Dreamcast home port, but as soon as I saw that character, I'm like, oh, shoot, I got Street Fighter, and I got my boy from the Mega Man games. I'm in.
Your boy from the Mega Man games, Mega Man?
That's, yeah. That's
okay.
Your man from the Mega Man games.
Listen, I'm very straightforward here.
Knows what he likes.
Yeah.
But as with previous games, we're still doing 2-on-2. We're still doing free swapping, whatever you want. That's happening still. You can bring in both your characters. Both characters do super moves. What's new this time around is you can have both your characters on screen at the same time. And if you're very adept, you can have them do different stuff and maybe even surround an opponent and get the drop on them and do all kinds of wackiness. It comes with a very great screen, you know, which for me is an Incredible Hulk viewer as a kid. I was very into this thing where the two characters' profiles slam together on the screen. So, you'll have like Hulk and Venom or Spider-Man and Venom or just, you know, Mega Man and you or whatever. Like they fit together like Legos and it's really funny. And then just utter chaos. Because, of course, both players can do it at the same time. So, in theory, you can have four characters rumbling about all, you know, all against each other. Just madness.
I feel like those portraits are very iconic because I've seen so many people just do, like, send-ups of those with all sorts of characters who weren't in this game. And they look really cool. They're very well-done art. Who's the artist on this one?
Kino Nishimura did a couple of the key images.
Is the goat.
Yeah, she is the goat. Akiman, I think, did the famous one where, like, all the characters are sort of, like, in profile looking at each other. I think that's Akiman. But I want to say that, like, this is sort of the end of that sort of iconic run, that period of Capcom fighting game art that people still sort of refer back to and do send-ups of, what you were talking about. I really like the cover art and the poster art for Marvel vs. Capcom 2, but it's not really sort of like stuck in the imagination of people like the art for this game was. And we're still talking about in modern fighting game terms, this is a really relatively small cast.
Yes.
But at the time, I mean, it was a probably average, maybe a little less than average size cast. So it wasn't unheard of to have, I mean, this many characters, but having them all kind of clumped together in such a way and in such a dynamic way in some of the art that's really stuck with people for a long, long time. And I still love looking at that stuff. I can't get enough of it.
We do a quick rundown of the cast. There are only 15 characters, which is, you know, a little less than the earlier games. But some of these sprites are brand new. You know, not everything is not all recycled content like the last game we talked about. This is, you know, they have some new sprites here. They certainly have a lot of new backgrounds and new music. So we've got Chun-Li, of course. We got Yu, of course. We got Zangief, okay. We got Morgan, sure. We've got Captain Commando, and he's got some of his squad mates with him for like a special assists. We've got Mega Man. We've got Strider Hiryu, which is definitely kind of a weird pull at the time. However, you know, this is 1988. You know, a year from now, Strider will be back in Strider 2, which will be an arcade release and a home release. And I think everyone will suddenly say, hey, remember Strider? Strider's cool. Because in this game, Strider's really cool.
Yeah, I think this is where Strider hit his stride, if you will. First Strider games from, what, 89, and then nothing other than the really awful European sequels that no one wants to think about. So really, this was a deep cut, and they pulled him from obscurity and made him seem like the most badass ninja that's ever been in a video game.
And certainly this look would be his look going forward with the big scarf. You know, he did not have a scarf in 89. He didn't. No scarf.
I want to say that this was like the canary in the coal mine. Like, if people really connect to Strider in this game, okay, let's make some more Strider games. Maybe I think that this was sort of the beginning of something to see if people were really going to be interested.
It's a classic Capcom test. Here's this old thing. You like this old thing? We'll give you more of it. Otherwise, we forget. We forget. Who's that? Strider? We don't know her. Spider-Man back, of course. Jin Sao Tome, definitely a strange pull, because that's Cyberbots, right? Which Cyberbots... Was Cyberbots ever released in America, or just like a very limited release?
It came out over here. I think it was on PS1 at the very least. I don't remember if it got an arcade release. I think it did.
Because I remember seeing Devilot in Puzzle Fighter, and her win quote's like, "What do you mean you don't know who I am?" You know, Cyberbots was very popular, and like that was a joke to me. It was like, "Oh, I've never heard of that game." But this is not Devilot. It's Jin Sao Tome.
It's a very strange cut because, like, Cyberbots is a game where they're fighting in giant robots, and here he, like, summons the robot for super moves and such, but, like, he's just a guy fighting on foot. And, I mean, he's cool. He's a super cool character, super cool design. I had a friend from the arcade back in the day, and she loved picking Jin because you could bash the button and he would do his taunt where he takes off all his clothes and just starts rubbing himself with the towel.
Yep.
And she thought that was great, especially if you kept mashing it, he'd just keep going until he caught himself on fire.
Yes, this is a man with burning passion, we should say. He's got a lot of heat in his body. He's ready to release that heat.
He's Genki. If you like mashed up Ryu with Batsu from Rival Schools and made him a mech pilot, this is who we're talking about.
Captain America is back. Venom, definitely a big pull to have Venom in the game, because by this point, Venom is a very well-known character, I think, to even like peripheral Marvel fans who don't read comics, that by now they've seen Venom probably in other video games, at the very least, or maybe the Spider-Man cartoon on Fox. Like, Venom's out there. Everyone knows Venom. So to have him in the game, big deal. And he's not just Spider-Man a different color. It is a new sprite, very different, plays different. He's very fluid. He's got very like splashy moves, like literally splashing. Hulk is there. Everyone knows Hulk. Gambit certainly. Gambit's an existing sprite from earlier games. War Machine. I feel like the inclusion of War Machine is an indication of how people really didn't care about Iron Man before 2008, because they already had Iron Man. Like, Iron Man is in a bunch of earlier games, but they decided, you know what? We're going to take Iron Man and we're going to swap him out for War Machine, by which I mean we're going to color him differently, we're going to call him War Machine, and we're going to give him basically one new move which launches missiles. Otherwise, it's basically Iron Man in MVC1. That changes in future games. But for now, War Machine is here. Welcome to War Machine. And Wolverine, of course, Wolverine.
Gotta have Wolverine.
I think War Machine might have been a Marvel mandate, personally, because like at the time... they were really trying to push War Machine as a big new hero around this period. Like, they were giving him a new book, his own book. They threw a lot of really good talent at the books that they were giving War Machine and the appearances that he was in, like really well-known artists and stuff like that. I don't know that for sure, but just the timing seems to line up. So that's my headcanon.
This was when Venom was really taking off too. Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was a request from Marvel as well.
The Venom sprite is really incredible. They put a lot of work into it.
Just like all the moving parts.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned a couple times last time, Kevin, like Spiral and Shuma-Gorath were basically just the Capcom artists kind of flexing, and that's what Venom sort of feels like to me, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, lots of moves where he can extend his sort of, you know, symbiote slime, whatever you want to call it, like across the screen, webs he can shoot out that just cover the entire screen. Really a big flashy character, fun to look at. Now you'll notice I didn't say the words Ken or Akuma, but they're in the game sort of, because Ryu is now your all-purpose Shotokan guy. So for the cost of one super move, you can turn you into his cohorts. So he'll change colors, his geek color will change, and then he will just do Ken moves, or he'll do Akuma moves. Like, that's your choice. So by taking those characters out, they sort of left their moves in. And I kind of wish more games would do this, because, I don't know, I mean, I guess now these days, the characters do have a little more variety, but in the 90s, they weren't that different. So in games that had very limited, resources, and certainly memory still cost a lot of money, especially arcade games, I was happy to see that change. Like, oh, you want to do Ryu or Ken or Akuma? Okay, just pick this one guy, and you get the total package.
Yeah, it was a great idea, and if they'd set it up so, like, you could start as one of them, I think it would have... I really think that should have stuck more, but what are you going to do?
I love this. I remember reading about this before the game came out, and I'm like, that is such a good idea. Why did it take so long for us to do something like that? And I think, like, you know, Marvel Superheroes versus Capcom could have done this and added another character in the place of either Ken or of Ken, at least, and that would have made the game a little bit more more interesting to me, I guess. But no, I really like this idea.
Also, rounding out the characters, you have hidden characters who are mostly palette swaps, but not all of them. We've got a Orange Hulk, who did not exist at that point, but later on there would be an Orange Hulk. Officially, he is Hulk Marvel Superheroes version, which means he doesn't have the super armor, and I guess he's a little bit faster, but not that much faster, I don't think.
He can sort of combo a lot easier, but
yeah.
You know, without the super armor, why would you pick him?
Yeah, it's just a big target at that.
Yeah.
We have Hyper Armor War Machine, who is gold-colored, and like the name suggests, he has hyper armor. He's got super armor. He actually can't block. If you play as him, he cannot block, but he's very powerful because he's got the hyper armor and because he's got such, you know, like War Machine, a lot of other Iron Mans in later games, he can do so much damage in such a hurry. He's very dangerous. We have, again, officially High-Speed Venom, who is red. So people said, oh, red, like Carnage? Or other people said, oh, you mean like Phage? Like Real Marvel Sicko said, oh, you mean like Phage? But he's just, you know, he's a little faster version of Venom. So I guess they made him, you know, red.
He's also, like, just insanely good in this game. Like, Venom was not meant to be that fast, but here he is.
I think he has a two-button infinite, just, like, off the ground, I believe.
I'm pretty sure that's true, yeah.
Wait, there's an infinite in this game?
I know, I'm shocked.
Whoa, take it easy.
It's an easy one to find, I've been told. Roll's a unique sprite, but let's face it. As Mega Man's sister, she has a lot of similar attacks to Mega Man and use some vehicles. But they actually made a unique Roll sprite, which is very nice. She has a broom, you know, good for her. Keeping the place clean. We have Shadow Lady, who is basically Dark Chun-Li, but they give her a lot more tools to play with, like beam attacks and drill attacks. And she will bow to you and fire a bunch of missiles. Let's not ask where the missiles come from. We don't know. We don't want to know. She's got missiles. Let's just accept that for who she is.
I like that they gave her the drill that Apocalypse had in the previous games. It's like, that's a choice.
And fresh off the introduction of Lilith in Vampire Savior in 97, you've got Red Morrigan, who's essentially Lilith. She's got some different moves, but basically, it's Lilith Light, if you will. Lilith adjacent. Not Lilith Sprite, but, you know, same Morgan Sprite, same pixels, just new colors and some more hearts.
I think that's interesting because this is really Morgan's first appearance outside of the Darkstalkers games, right? Mm. With the sprite that they're going to use for a million more games. But she's very much, like, based on sort of, like, her ending from, or I guess Lilith's ending from Vampire Savior, where the two of them, like, merge and she gets her full power. Because all of her fireballs are, like, the EX versions from Vampire Savior. Her moves are supposed to be super powerful. She's got her beam attacks. And, yeah, having this, like, alternate Lilith form is very interesting. Because those attacks also seem a little improved upon from Vampire Savior as well. And I understand, like, technically speaking, that's just to keep her up with the Marvel characters. We're shooting beams and everything everywhere, but I think, you know, just storyline-wise, canonically, I think it also works really well.
It's a good fit for her, but yes, as, you know, as discussed in earlier games, you know, when they brought out all the Alpha Crew, like, all of a sudden everyone's moves just got giant size, so it makes sense to give her bigger fireballs, larger beams. Though there's some fan art just recently went around suggesting that because Morrigan summons giant beam attacks and gives off a jetpack, she's actually just a big, like, Gundam nerd. So
there was a nice
sketch going around of Morrigan is going out shopping with glasses on and a big hoodie and some nice relaxed pants and just going shopping for plastic models. Like, I thought that was very funny. Good artwork there.
Do they both have a Shin Gokusatsu?
She has her, like, beat-em-up move that she had from the original Darkstalkers. I mean, it's not quite a Shin Gokusatsu, but it's like, it's a short range, like, she's going to beat you up. Like, she summons a double, and they both do a combo on you.
Right,
so,
okay.
The Darkness Illusion, I think it's called.
I wish the viewers could see my excellent finger work here to demonstrate how two Morrigans punch and kick you at the same time.
It's like you're making marionettes dance over there.
You know, they say that print is dead, but someone forgot to tell the folks at Old School Gamer that that's the case. Old School Gamer has been running for years, documenting and celebrating video games, arcade games, computer games, and more, spanning from the 1970s through the 90s. Each issue is packed with interviews with and articles by the people who were there making the games. In addition to columns, retrospectives, and reviews, and more, that dive into the ways that people celebrate the early days of video games. But I hear your skepticism. You've bought into the hype that print is dead. Well, the good news is that Old School Gamer is also digital, and every issue also comes in a free digital version that gets you access to the first half of that issue, so you can check it out and see for yourself, and realize that what you really want is the full paid print and digital companion version. That gets you 6 issues a year, each containing 72 pages or more of a print magazine about video games. If you're old enough to remember all these old games that are being covered, you're old enough to remember what it was like to swing by the newsstand and browse through the magazines like Game Informer, EGM, OPM, and more. Old School Gamer magazine tries to evoke that spirit while also embracing the digital preferences of today's readers. So check it out at oldschoolgamer.com. Or better yet, go to oldschoolgamer.com/retronauts, where there's a special offer available. Retronauts listeners can subscribe to the magazine by the end of November and receive a bonus issue that includes the most recent issue of the magazine, which has a column by a guy named Jeremy Parrish talking about old NES and Famicom games. That alone, in my opinion, is worth the price of admission, but you also get 6 more issues, which will also contain columns by me. That's a total of 7 issues of Old School Gamer plus more words by Jeremy Parrish. Just go to oldschoolgamer.com/retronauts and get ready to relive the old days of games and print about games.
Speaking of marionettes and assist characters, we have special partners. This is a new feature where they decided, you know what? 2 characters is good, but what if we have a third semi-present character who just shows up and does one thing? You know, and this is 98, so this is advance of KOF Striker System, which won't come till 99. And also what's advice about this is, since the character only comes in and does one thing, it's not that many frames of animation, so they get a little weird. You know, of course, they call back to some characters who didn't make the cut, like Cyclops and Magneto and Colossus and Iceman, but they also throw in new characters, or at least new to the series, like Arthur from Ghouls and Ghosts shows up and throws a bunch of, like, you know, javelins, Devilot. I said Devilot. Devilot's in the game. She shows up and explodes.
Mm-hmm.
You got Anita from, you know, Darkstalkers Night Warriors. You've got the Tompu, the Kung Fu ladies from Strider. You got Unknown Soldier from Forgotten Worlds. Like, they're really doing some flexing here. Again, going back to the past and having characters just show up and do, you know, a quick thing. The guy from Three Wonders.
This
who
is worth.
Three Wonders? Raise your hand. Three Wonders fans. Raise your hands out there.
I was today years old when I learned where Lou came from because I had no idea. I like Saki here from Quiz Nanairo Dreams, who became like an actual character in Tatsunoko versus Capcom. But
a good one,
She's a pretty good assist in this one. Like, not an amazing one, but pretty good. She had a really easy, like, button code if you just wanted to pick her. Because, yeah, all of these are, like, semi-random, but if you hold down a button combination when you pick your characters, you'll always get, like, the same one for whatever given combo. And hers, I think, was just heavy punch or something.
Yeah.
So I got her a lot.
And these are finite, too. You can't just, like, call them in whenever they're ready. Like, you've got maybe six times per match of using a Colossus, who is kind of the preferred pick for a lot of people because he just does his sort of, like, rushing shoulder charge, in you know, armored shoulder charge. So, yeah.
He's on the screen for a long time.
For a long time, yeah. And he's got a pretty wide hitbox, too. So he'll put out – he'll find you. But, yeah, you can't just, like, use them willy-nilly. You have to at least sort of plan how often you want to hit the Colossus button. Or at least
I think Iceman was really good, too, wasn't he?
Yeah, because it's all – it's just the – oh, it's the big boulder, right?
Yeah, he's dropping, like, a bunch of blocks of ice from the sky.
Yeah.
Like, blocks down a lot of the screen. I always liked Jubilee, but she kind of sucked.
That's the thing. Like, I think a lot of these are awesome deep cuts, like, you know, Legendary Wings and Forgotten Worlds. It's cool for, like, old nerds like us, but it sucks when they also suck. So, nothing you can do about it. Pick Cyclops or Colossus or whatever.
My favorite was that they had U.S. Agent in here. And
they do?
And Cap is right there.
And they had, like, a running gag in my friend group because someone went on, like, this giant win streak using the U.S. Agent assist, and we just came away with it, like, all right, I guess U.S. Agent's just, like, the best character in the game, because no one can beat him. And he actually sucks, but it's really funny, and now that just is how I associate U.S. Agent in my head. And I'm like, oh, he's someone who should suck, but, you know, he went on a tear.
And we're recording this in 2024, so isn't U.S. Agent coming back in the Thunderbolts movie? That's
yeah,
right. Ugh. They had the disgraced Captain America, and now he's going to be U.S. Agent. So they're following the comic books a little bit, but they're doing a different thing. And well, whatever. We need to get in the Marvel movies right now. But U.S. Agent relevant again in the 21st century. Who would have saw that coming?
How?
Speaking of 90s characters we don't talk about anymore, who wants to explain Onslaught to the children? Anyone?
I'm gonna throw that one to John. Although, you know, they did set up a little bit of an Onslaught story in X-Men 97, so maybe
I thought
folks,
they were gonna do it.
Maybe folks are primed.
I thought they were gonna whip that out. Yeah, I thought they were gonna whip that out. I was surprised that they didn't go all for it, but like we already know more X-Men 97 is coming, so yeah. Go ahead, John. Set us up for X-Men 97 Part 2.
Well, it's funny that we're bringing up X-Men 97 because the last time we recorded a podcast, it was not quite before that show debuted, and all of us are like, this is a huge mistake. Why is Marvel spending money on this? And it turned out to be
incredible.
Really awesome. Yeah, just so much better than we all expected it to be. But, all right, I'm going to preface this by saying that I was getting out of comics, kind of, at the point where this happened, but I had worked in a comic book shop when I was in high school when Onslaught was happening. So let me do my best to to summon that. So there was a massive crossover across all the X-Men books, and I want to say that this was like 96, 97, around that time. And there were many, many, many X-Men books at that point where Professor X's son, Legion, sort of fused on. There's going to be somebody in the comments that's just going to, like, rake me over the coals for this. But, like,
less
Professor
is more,
X's
John. Less is more.
Son,
you know?
Sort of, yeah. We're going to minimize this. Kind of fuses together Professor X and Magneto's psyches and creates this uber monster universe-destroying being named Onslaught. And this was at a point where many Marvel fans were like, we've had enough of this kind of bullshit. And so, like, this is another reason even the X-Men books were just not doing very well at this point, because, like, people were really sick of big crossovers in the comics, because, I mean, if you want to read all the stories, you're buying, like, 5 or 6 or 10 extra books every month, if not more. It was really not a good storyline. I don't think it's really got a lot of, like, long-term fans. But if it's coming back for X-Men 97, who the hell knows? But, yeah, so somehow, after this was all over and was not really that big of a success from what I recall, this is what Capcom used as their successive Ultra Boss past Apocalypse. But I guess from a gameplay standpoint, and if you're going to one-up Apocalypse, it does kind of make sense because it's such a large enemy to fight. It starts as a small one and gets to be a huge cosmic one. It kind of fits. it's just one of those things that in hindsight, not to keep referring back to the last episode, although it's awesome and you should listen to it, but we were talking about how you shouldn't look at certain Marvel characters' designs at the point where Marvel Super Heroes versus Street Fighter came out. And that is this, that is more of this, that you, it's tough to sort of go back to those Marvel comics at that point and accept their merits. But like, this is something that I think Capcom just like backed themselves into a corner to use. And like, all right, we've got to do something bigger than Apocalypse. We did a Cyber Akuma and it didn't really, I mean, it was a smaller scale. So we got to go big. We're Marvel versus Capcom. And yes, I'm sorry, everybody. I had to bore you with that.
You know, at least he looks cool. You got to give Onslaught that. His sprite is cool. And you know, the concept is interesting. I understand why they've brought him back a few times in the comics since this. Why he'll probably be in X-Men 97 at some point.
Yeah, X-Men 97 kind of like does their best to sort of like just choose major stories and do like one episode of it. And I think this is a foregone conclusion at this point.
But you know what? If they can salvage Madeline Pryor, I'm sure they can salvage Onslaught.
Right.
Anyway, the onslaught we get on screen is a very tall, you know, if you're not in on the comics, you'd think, oh, it looks like Magneto, because it does look like Magneto. It's got red and purple armor, but like, imagine, you know, more shoulder pads. No, more shoulder pads.
All of
no,
them. That's, all the shoulder pads.
Yes. There's no Mole Man saying that's too big. No, Mole Man does not exist. We're going big, we're going bigger. And he just kind of sits there a little bit. He has big beam attacks. He's got like Magneto attacks. He can teleport around a little bit. Onslaught can sort of back out and summon another character to fight you for a little bit. It's usually a clone of you. Just for a few seconds, just like wear you down a little bit. And kind of like the general strategy in this phase is like, you want to block a lot and you want to try to get in hits when you can, because Onslaught is basically constantly armored. Like you can't really loosen him up. You can't really do a combo. Like if he wants to attack you and you hit him first, he's going to hit you out of whatever you're doing. As I recall, I think Mega Man's such a tiny sprite. I think the down fierce attack is just a projectile attack, so you can just spam that and just shoot him to death and win round one easy with Mega Man.
Or I think you could turn into the rush car, because I'm pretty sure he's invincible during he's doing his rush car and get all the hits in.
Yeah, if you build up a super, yeah, you can do that one too, and just run over Onslaught with your little car. But that's only round one, because round two, Onslaught says, all right, the gloves are off, my helmet is off, I've got a big scary face now, and I am now a giant sprite that is too big to fit on the screen. So Onslaught is now flying around the screen, doing lots of giant beam attacks, and it's kind of like, yeah, again, it's a level up from Apocalypse in the earlier games, except Apocalypse was always a ground level, whereas Onslaught is literally flying around the screen, so you're gonna need to do super jumps to catch him in the air. If you've got a ground-based super, good luck. Wait for him to come down, I guess. Otherwise, you may be in, you know, out of luck. Sorry. Should have brought a beam.
Yep.
Bring a beam to an Onslaught fight. It's good advice for all these Marvel games, honestly.
Right.
All these bosses. Bring a beam.
Somebody that shoots stuff. I just think that this is not that so far removed from the Apocalypse fight from before that I've never really thought that this was such a great ending, but like, I mean, the game is so good even beyond this that Onslaught gets a pass here.
Yeah, like the stages are super colorful and they're all like themed on the different characters. The music's, the covers of all the character themes are really good. Roll has like a whole vocal theme song when she comes out, which is a really cute touch that they ended up using again when she shows up in Tatsunoko versus Capcom. But yeah, the presentation of this game is like, for me, it's peak Marvel crossovers with Capcom.
I agree.
They did a great job with it.
I really love the Spider-Man stage and that, like, you're fighting on the top of two buildings, and the gap between the building is a webbing that Spider-Man had put there ahead of time. So when you walk over it, it doesn't really affect your character movement, but it, like, boings a little bit. And I always thought that was a great touch.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez, I guess this is 98, so I think that's the same year that the JoJo Fighter comes out, and that also has a building top with some webbing on it. Interesting. intriguing.
Capcom was cooking up buildings.
Everything is JoJo. Like,
I do like the fact that so much of the characters have like interplay. Different teams have different quotes together. Indeed, this is the center point of the Spider-Man Morrigan coupling online, because if you pick them together, Spider-Man makes some joke about, oh, don't tell MJ I'm out late or whatever. And so people, to this day, people are drawing art of Spider-Man and Morrigan hanging out together or even dating, which is just, you know, just cute. You know, it's fun. No harm there. They're both adults.
I love the concept of them as just, like, buddies going out for, like, a burger or whatever after the fight. You know, Morrigan is just this, like, nerdy goblin. Is a very fun characterization that Capcom should just embrace. Let her be a gremlin.
They shop for Gunpla together.
Yeah. Yeah, sure, why not? This still fits. It all fits together.
Uh-huh. I mean, she's buying because he's Spider-Man, doesn't have any money. But, that's true. You know, he's along for moral support.
I really love, I don't know all the endings by heart, but I know that if you beat the game with Mega Man, you get a really perfect Mega Man style, you got screen, where he gets the magnetic shockwave from an Onslaught, and he beat Onslaught and got his weapon. And it's just a pitch-perfect recreation of Mega Man stuff. Like, oh, yes, that's good. Yes.
Yeah, I think it's just, like, straight up the Mega Man 8, like, you got sequence just with, like, the Marvel Capcom font. It's really cute.
It's beautiful. And he uses it, and it's crazy overpowered. It's perfect. And I think in some home ports, I think you actually use it, I think.
That sounds right. I think he does get to keep it in some of the home ports as an actual thing that you can unlock. It's been a while since I've loaded up on Dreamcast. I should check that.
Well, there are two home ports of note we should mention right away. There's a PlayStation version and a Dreamcast version. They're both out in Japan in 1999. I think the English PS1 version doesn't come out till 2000 because they probably waited to localize it. The PS version, though, not well received because, let's face it, this many sprites, this much memory, you can only fit so much into the data stream. So I think there's no swapping, right? No character swapping?
I think you can character swap if you're both using the same teams, because I know that's how the older games worked on this, and it's not great.
Yeah, it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
But the Dreamcast one's a great port.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure if that wasn't a launch game in the US, it was pretty close. I know it came out in Japan like right around my birthday, so for my birthday in 99... my buddy brought his Japanese Dreamcast and a copy of Marvel 1 over, and we just played the crap out of that for like 3 hours. It was a great time.
Awesome.
Not great with the Dreamcast controller, but, you know, that's why you get the Green Goblins, right? The Age Tech sticks.
The best arcade stick ever produced.
It's true.
Also, we should point out the fact that in 2012, many years later, when Capcom tried to dig up their Marvel license again and refurbish it, they had a Marvel vs. Capcom Origins pack on Xbox Live and PlayStation Network, which was a bundle of superheroes and Marvel Capcom 1. So it was one price. You get both these games, remastered, online play, you know.
Rollback.
Still the same old graphics, but, you know, higher resolution. It came out in 2012. It was delisted the next year, but if you bought them, you can still download them. I have two broken PS3s in my home, and if I got them working again, I could just play that game right now. I could do that, but I can't because they're broken.
Yeah, if I remember, this was the same group that did like HD Remix and Third Strike Online Edition. So like, they were one of the only development houses doing rollback netcode at that time on retail games. Since that was a fairly new technology at the time. And I remember the online was pretty good for these. It's just, you know, you could only buy it for about a year.
Mm. Yeah, Iron Galaxy, I think, right?
That sounds right.
Yeah, I don't really think that this sold very well either. I think this is also a point where Capcom had put out or was about to put out the Darkstalkers re-releases on PS3 and Xbox 362 again to see if they could drum up some interest in further stuff. And didn't take as well. You know, they did the Marvel vs. Capcom 2 re-release prior to this, and I think people were so shocked by that, it sold really well. But I think that, you know, the MVC Origins thing was a clear indicator that, you know, the interest was only for maybe this one game and not for future stuff or even other games in the sub-series, which is sad.
Again, the infamous Capcom test.
It wasn't HD Remix they did. It was Darkstalkers Resurrection was the other one I was thinking of.
Right. Yeah, Backbone did HD Remix.
Yes, which, you know, Darkstalkers Resurrection was, and it, Third Strike Online Edition were sort of the go-tos before the current ports. And I guess Third Strike might still be. I think people really like that version of the game.
Yeah. I'm going to say yes, and we can move on. I know how Kevin hates for me to talk about Third Strike, so. You're off the hook.
Oh, hello. I didn't see you there. My name's Stuart Jipp. I'm the author of the book All Games Are Good, available through limitedrungames.com. Now, normally, we charge a sort of regular price for this book, which I'm very satisfied with, but to my great displeasure, it has been placed on a 25% discount for the next couple of weeks, actually. Through November 27th, you'll be able to get a quarter, 25%, off my book. I was not consulted about this, and I have to admit, I'm actually livid. The fact that Jeremy Parrish's NezWorks, yeah, that's right, NezWorks 1985 through 1986 is also on sale, is immaterial. My book should be sold at full price. And, you know, if you do buy my book for 25% off, which is, of course, full of entertaining and interesting opinions about video games, then, frankly, I'm going to be furious.
It is time. Let us graduate to the year 2000. It's a new age of heroes, a new millennium. Marvel vs. Capcom 2, I should say. Now on Naomi, the brand new Naomi board. So we've got more power than ever before. It arrives early 2000. I want to say February 2000 in Japan, in arcades, and probably I'm seeing it in America pretty early because I think they just imported a Japanese cabinet. That's my memory. At least, again, I lived in New York, so I had the advantage. But I would assume most places, if they could afford it, would have gotten a Japanese cabinet right away because the anticipation was pretty high. I mean, I know when I heard about it, I was like, oh, yes, more Marvel Capcom, especially when I saw the numbers because we're dealing with Naomi here. Memory isn't quite as expensive as it was in the past. So they decided, oh, we're bringing everybody back. We're getting the band back together. We're bringing them all back. Now, it's not everybody, of course. But in the year 2000, you know, this is a time when Mugen already exists. Capcom definitely went for more is more. We want more characters. We want to have as many possible characters. I believe the number is 56, which is a very impressive two-digit figure. That is like, that's like KOF 98 numbers, you know?
Yeah, I think it's up to this point, it was the most characters in a fighting game, and I think even now, there's not very many that surpass 56 playable characters.
Hmm.
Playable. I should put that in quote marks, because we'll get into that a little more when we get to it.
Yeah, and if you look at the roster, of course, most of these sprites are from older games. That's, you know, that's the whole point. We have all these sprites around, let's use them. There are a couple new ones, a couple newcomers we can point out. You know, We've got Cable. Cable's certainly a 2000s choice, you know, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. Very timely. Kind of the default character, I think, on some play, like, when you start up this look screen, I think Cable's one of the default ones.
Yeah.
He's like, he's an all-rounder guy. He's really powerful. He's got a lot of beams. You know, very, very strong choice for beginners or experts or anyone, really.
Yeah, Cable's a boss in this game.
Mm-hmm. Tronbon from the recent Mega Man Legends games, very popular character. She's got her own little mech, very adorable. Hayato from Star Gladiator, definitely a surprise.
You know, laser sword. It was a recent Capcom fighting game. They're like, oh, let's cross promote, I guess. I don't know. He's a very strange pick, but he's kind of cool looking in that like edgy 90s way.
Maybe he was supposed to be the Strider stand-in, because Strider is noticeably absent from this game.
No, he's here.
Oh, is he in this one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
that's why
I'm
you
wrong.
Got Strider Doom is like a whole famous team.
Keep my mouth shut and let you guys continue.
No, Strider's here. We got Ruby Heart, Space Pirate.
Yeah, she's one of the original characters for this one, isn't she?
Yeah.
That's Capcom. That's Capcom creation. Also, Living Cactus Amingo from the Samba de Amingo games.
Amingo's so cool. I'm pretty sure if the top characters weren't like in this game, Amingo would be the boss, because he has a lot of really fun stuff.
I think looking back at this game, the one character most people do not remember at all is Marrow. And Marrow is a very 2000s Marvel type. That's what she grows her bones, right? She grows her bones and throws her bones.
Right.
She's got too much bones in her.
And why not? Yeah, this is, as 2000s X-Men comics go, this is the most 2000s X-Men comics character they could find. Yeah, and you almost never see her in competitive play, like, ever, ever, ever. So, there's an interview with Arcadia Magazine with the director and the producer, Nakae and Sudo, and they were saying that Marrow and Cable were suggestions by a Capcom employee that was extremely well-versed in American comics, which is probably Akimoto, who had a hand in almost all of the pre-Marvel versus Capcom Marvel crossover games, or the Capcom Marvel games, we should say. So it was his idea. Cable's not really that deep of a cut. Marrow at the time kind of wasn't either. She was in the comics, but she's still, like, there are probably still more better known Marvel characters that they could have chosen. I don't really get the Marrow thing, but she is really distinct on screen, which in this game is pretty important because it moves at such a pace. You really want to, your eyes need to be able to track these kinds of characters. And she's got such a sort of bright color palette and distinct look to her that was maybe a reasoning, but yeah, I don't know. Marrow, I don't get it.
No, it's right up there with the Shuma Gorath pick from Marvel Superheroes.
Yeah.
Also, very exciting for me personally as a Resident Evil fan, I was elated to see that Jill Valentine made the jump from 3D to 2D, and she shows up and she brings zombies with her. She's got moves where she summons zombies and dogs, and just so happy to see her here. She's, you know, I think anime Jill Valentine is seen in this game is adorable. I think it's great. I wish more games took gruff and serious characters and gave them this kind of treatment. You know, I love it.
And she heals.
It's a great sprite.
She brings the herb with her. It's still kind of a rare thing in fighting games at that point.
Native to the Arklay Mountains.
I liked that they added in both regular, like, adamantium Wolverine and also Bone Claw Wolverine, who is basically just the same character, but faster and with less health somehow, because Wolverine already had barely any health. The only reason to have him here is so you can do a double Wolverine team, I guess, but he's sure there.
Also a Marvel mandate, apparently, according to this Arcadia interview. It was Marvel put their foot down on this specifically. They wanted both Wolverines in the game.
Which is weird, because like 2000, he already had his adamantium back by then, didn't he?
Probably. Yeah, I think you're right.
But that, of course,
strange.
That whole storyline was related to the Onslaught thing in the first place, right? Like, didn't Onslaught come about because Magneto took the metal out of Wolverine's bones, and Professor X, like, said, that's enough, you're gone too far, my friend, and then they fought, and they... Whatever, I'm not gonna... It's a long story. But as I said...
The instant you started saying that, like, my eyes just kind of looked up, like, is that correct? Is that... I don't remember. So, yes, that's exactly why...
Right.
But I'm just surprised they didn't do just one or the other. Like, you know, if it's important for them to have a bone Wolverine in the game, why not just have the bone Wolverine in there and just have a Wolverine? I think you're right, Kevin. It was an opportunity for people to, like, here's the one super popular character that we still have. Play as two of them.
Yeah.
Although I do believe the home versions just let you pick the same character over and over, can't you? Like, the arcade one says no, but...
You can unlock that as an option.
Right. Because I definitely have memories of playing Three Cables. I have that memory.
Three Juggernauts was one of my favorite teams. All of them can do the power-up glitch. then every assist is painful.
Yeah, as you might have guessed, with 56 characters in the roster, things change. It's no longer 2-on-2. We now are going 3-on-3. Not only is it 3-on-3, all your characters, you can swap at any time. And as a sort of an allusion to the last game, you can summon your partners in to do assist maneuvers. They'll just jump in, they'll do something, and they'll jump back out. And you have some control over this, because when you choose your characters, you choose what type they are. I believe in the Japanese version, it's alpha, beta, gamma, but in the English versions, they sort of give you like a keyword, like anti-air or, you know, projectile. Yeah. They give you like a hint.
An expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when you pick that, that determines what their assist move is, and that also determines what super move that is if you call them in to do a big group super. And let's be frank, this explodes the game into territory that no one could have possibly anticipated. You know, you want infinites, it's like infinites. Like, everyone can do so much. You can have, you know, potentially you can have six characters on the screen all doing different moves at each other. Like, that can happen. And it does happen.
This game's bonkers.
yeah.
I don't know that there was really any attempt on Capcom's part to just balance things out. It really feels like they just threw everything in there.
More is more. Yes.
Took like a pass on it, and they're like, "Ah, good enough. We need to get this out the door." Because some of these characters are like really awful, and some of it's by design. Like the little serve bot, the Kobun, he's awful. He's a joke character. He doesn't really do much of anything. He's just very small. Roll is kind of a joke. She doesn't really get to do very much. But then you have a character like Magneto, who is super fast and could just get on top of you super easily. You have Storm, who has a super where she just drops hail over the entire screen, and you can't really get away from it. You just have to, like, take the hit or take the block damage. And then on the other hand, you have, Guile throwing a little sonic boom.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they just threw it all together and let people cook, really. That's what it feels like. And
yeah, a lot of the classic Street Fighter characters really seem to get the short shrift in this game. Maybe by virtue of just like how their move set was already sort of kind of set in stone before something like this was ever dreamed up. But, you know, Kevin basically just mentioned two of the three most used characters in the game, Storm and Magneto. And the other one is Sentinel, because he could fly around the stage at will. So he can, in a game series that really sort of forced you to be jumping all the time, like you're constantly in the air, you're air dashing all the time. Being on the ground is not really going to do you any good in most situations. You've got to be zipping around the stage. There are characters that could literally just fly around the stage. And because those things were there, one of the best parts of this game and one of the more interesting aspects of it is that you really have to start thinking in terms of team composition. And those are not my words. Seth Killian wrote a really, really great fighting game primer for what was Gamma Sutra like 15 years ago. And, you know, he mentions that, like, okay, if you're going to be picking a character like Sentinel, then you should have an assist character that can do an anti-air that goes the full height of the screen, not just like Ryu doing an uppercut. You need like a laser beam that goes from the ground all the way through the top of the screen, because Sentinel is going to be at the top of the screen at some point, right? So people pick Sentinel, Cable, and Captain Commando, who is a lesser character in this game, but his anti-air is awesome because it does do that. So you really have to start thinking in terms of, like, when you want to play this at high level, who's going to be my point character? Who's the character that I can get in with and basically generate a lot of meter, harass the opponent enough that maybe I can take down one of their characters, but if not, it's okay. Who's the second character who's basically just going to be my assist? Who's the person that's just going to help my other characters either launch other people in the air or keep them locked into place? And then you've got an anchor character that's supposed to be like the big damage dealer. That's where like Storm comes in and stuff like that. So people have over the years really devised really interesting teams that think in those terms. Like, this is basically a card game and you're building a deck. Other really great players. I mean, and for decades, this was thought to be a set in stone thing, right? Like, these five or six characters are really just the game and everybody else is just window dressing. But guys like Justin Wong has made his bones the last 5 or 6 years or so by going deep into this game and saying, pretty much everybody is viable. We can do 100% combos with pretty much any team. It's doable. There's just so much weird stuff happening in this game. And by virtue of how the game engine works, not everybody is going to be good as everybody else, but at least almost the entire cast can do some wild stuff. And that's why it's sort of endured as long as it has.
Oh, yeah. They also added Anacharous to this game.
Yeah.
From Darkstalkers. He's another newcomer to the series. And, like, he can do wacky stuff. Like, even in terms of a Darkstalkers character, like, summoning the sarcophagi to just drop on people from, like, the very top of the screen. Like, if he did not have to deal with Magneto, he would be wild and, like, super strong.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you're playing him and you need to put him with someone who can take out the problem characters for him and hope like heck that you don't get him snapped in. Like, that's one of the new functions in the game, is you can snap in one of your opponent's other characters. So you can wail on them if they have, like, a bad matchup or if they're weak and they're trying to heal them up. So, you know, there's a lot of strategy in this game. This is actually the game that got me interested in fighting games competitively. I was never any good at it, mind you, but it was this one when it came out. At that point, I had a job so I could go to the arcade. So I started going to the arcade to play Marvel 2. I got a fight stick. I got a Green Goblin to play the Dreamcast port because, you know, trying to play this game on a Dreamcast pad is awful, awful. Cannot recommend it. Hurts your thumb. But yeah, this was such, like, this game was a huge thing for around the crowds that I hung out in.
And it remained a huge thing forever. And that's maybe getting ahead of ourselves, but back to something that you said a second ago, this was actually, like, the control scheme for this game was built around the Dreamcast pad in mind. It's, instead of six buttons across, three punches, three kicks, it's two punches, two kicks, and you're supposed to chain the two light ones together. The second hit of the chain is the medium attack.
Come on, John, say the line. Say the line.
Hmm?
Medium punch, which is light punch twice. Light punch, medium punch, which is light punch twice.
Excuse me. Medium punch, which is light punch twice. And so the other two buttons from the six are your assist buttons. Like, one character is assigned it to each of them. And in that Arcadia interview that we mentioned earlier, they come right out and say that, like, we built this for, like, people to take their Dreamcast controllers to an arcade and hook it up to an arcade cabinet in Japan and play this game. And what the hell? I would never do that.
Yeah. And having that, like, button change to make medium punch basically inaccessible, that hurt a number of characters. Like, Hulk's medium buttons are great, but you can't really use them. And Hulk, outside of those, has really awful normal buttons. So he's not particularly useful in this game or very good. And I know this was sort of a point of contention very early on when this game came out, because a lot of people that got big into the earlier games, particularly Marvel Capcom 1, because that was a pretty good hit, they were really upset that you no longer had access to all your buttons. And I remember a lot of them dropped Marvel for Marvel 2, or dropped Marvel 2 when
back.
It came out because of that.
Wow.
And then, but it didn't matter because a bunch of other people came in and were like, hey, this game is sick. I'm in.
Yeah, the control scheme, absolutely. You can see they have consoles in mind, and we should also add the fact that this game arrived on Japanese Dreamcast barely a month after the arcade release. So they definitely knew at this point that the home version was going to have to, like, move a lot of units. Like, the arcade unit, the arcade was the arcades. And at least in Japan, this is very interesting. I did not know this because I didn't live in Japan. In Japan, they had a whole thing going on where you could bring, you know, like John said, again, you bring your controller, and more importantly, you bring your VMU to the arcades. And by connecting your VMU to the arcade cabinet, that's how you were able to unlock more characters for your home version.
Yep.
Whereas the home versions released overseas didn't really do that. It was just a simple point shop. So the more you played the game, the more points you got, the more things you could unlock. And that's how that worked. I think the arcades also, in like the American version that I saw, I think they were all time released. Like, the longer the game was running, the more characters would unlock.
Yes.
But this, in Japan, they had a whole, like, integral thing, which was, you know, very Neo Geo of them, which I appreciate. But yeah, I can't imagine bringing a controller to the arcade when I have a stick right there. You know, unless, am I supposed to bring my Dreamcast stick to the arcade? Because that's heavy. That's a beast.
Yeah, I remember the unlocks being a real point of contention, because I knew some friends who had imported the game, and they're like, okay, well, I can only unlock some of the characters without, you know, access to Japanese internet, because some of them you had to unlock by playing online matches using the Dreamcast modem.
Right, uh-huh. Dreamcast again, ahead of its time.
Obviously, that was not a functionality that they included in the U.S. release, so they just changed that. But in Japan, you needed that. You needed to be able to hook it into the arcade machines, and I remember there was an import store that actually sold save files that had everything unlocked for the Japanese version for, like, I forget, $5 or something. They would just pop in your VMU and put it on, copy it over to you and give it back. And I don't know how much business they did with that, but I would like to think that it was pretty brisk.
I downloaded one from GameFAQs. I remember I looked it up. Like, they had custom save files. I'm like, here's all the stuff for you. And I remember downloading that. I was like, yeah, I don't want to do all this. Just give it to me. Yeah. Which may have been a mistake. It may have been like going to the buffet and just like bringing a shovel. I'm like, okay, I want all my food at once. Ah. So, you know, I don't know if 23-year-old me was correct in that assumption, but that's what I did. And I guess that's a way to make money. Oh, sure. I found this internet. I'll give it to you for $5, kid. But sure.
The funniest thing for the time release on the arcade cabs is I had a friend in high school. He was the guy who got me into competitive fighting games in the first place. And I remember him getting super stoked when Thanos got unlocked at the local arcade. And, you know, Thanos, he was the boss of Marvel Superheroes. He was super busted in that game. So he was really excited. He's like, all right, Thanos is going to be so cool. I'm going to mess up everybody. He got there. Rushed in after school. Thanos sucks so bad in this game. He is so awful. He's slow. His buttons are awful. His supers are okay, but, like, why would you waste all your super meter on Thanos when you could, I don't know, pick Cable? So, he was very disappointed, and I feel like in our modern, you know, Thanos-brained world, we could all relate to being disappointed.
Yes, Marvel would never let that happen now.
No, they would insist that that Thanos be top tier.
Yes, that Thanos would be Cable in this game. I can't emphasize enough how good Cable is in this game. He's got a super that basically, like, strings into itself if you're, yes, you're good at the inputs. So yes, one touch from Cable will basically annihilate a whole character. And since assist characters still take damage too if they're out, yes, on the screen at the time. You know, there's plenty of video out there of in high level competition, and even frankly any kind of competition, where, like, accidentally all three characters from one side are on the screen, and then a Cable comes out and just levels them all with a Hyper Viper Beam, and it's just, you know, the whole match done in 10 seconds, and it's sad but funny. But please look those up; they're really satisfying.
Yeah, like, I'm not even good at this game, and I can pull off an air Hyper Viper Beam. I can't necessarily chain it into itself very consistently, but I can do one. And that's usually enough to, you know, wipe out an assist, because they take extra damage. So yeah, if it's a character that's already pretty squishy, like Strider or Psylocke, they are done. They're gone.
I've always found that this game, I'm going to also preface this by saying that I'm also not really a huge fan of this game. I really appreciate it from a distance. and for what it did for the American fighting game scene for as long as it did. And we'll get to that. But like, I've tried to learn this a couple of times, and I've had a lot of people try to sit down with me like, this is what this does, and this is how you should think, and blah, 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 blah. But I really think that this is definitely the most Capcom-y of Capcom fighting games where someone needs to teach you how to do these things. Like, someone needs, if you want to learn how to play fighting games competitively, largely, especially now with the internet, with YouTube, you can probably figure out most stuff on your own. Even the more obscure things, and even, you know, regular old World Warrior Street Fighter 2, you can figure out. But like, there was a lot of weird things happening under the hood in this game. Some of them can't possibly be there by design, like all the on-the-ground combos and relaunches and things like that, that couldn't have been there by design. But people have figured that out, and relatively quickly in this game's lifespan, that like, you need somebody to be like, all right, when you're Cable, or when you're this character, you do a super, you mash all the buttons on the stick because you're going to get more hits. The game doesn't tell you that, but it's there. You're going to get 25-35% more damage if you just start mashing buttons. Because there's just so much happening in this game all at once. It's super, it moves so quickly, and it's really, really easy to lose track of where you are and where the opponent is. That, like, unless you're really keyed in, it's a difficult game to sort of parse, even if you're just a casual observer, especially if you're a casual observer. So it's a fun party game, really, in that, like, if no one knows what they're doing, it is like just mashing all of your G.I. Joe guys together and seeing who wins. But like, when really good fighting game players come out, it's just, it's psychotic. It's impossible to really see what's going on unless you really know what to look for. It's a zany game.
It's fun to watch.
Yes.
All of these games that we're talking about are pretty fun to watch, like, people who know what they're doing play the game. And yeah, I also kind of bounced off it. As soon as Capcom vs. SNK1 came out, I just started playing that instead. But this was a really, like, formative game, I'd say, for the U.S. fighting game scene, because, you know, there was big in Street Fighter 2, and it was pretty big for Mortal Kombat 2 and 3 and Samurai Showdown. But the late 90s were not kind to it, because that's when fighting games stopped being as popular. And I feel like this game sort of sustained a scene for quite a while, right all the way through the doldrums of the 2000s. I remember, This was like the keynote game for the Evo series, even before it was Evo. Like, they would end their sessions with Marvel 2. And after Marvel 2, like, the last time they ran it, because Marvel 3 was coming out, I remember there's a video going around of just the organizers of the event just, like, smashing all of the broken Dreamcasts that had failed, like, over the course of the weekend. And they're like, I'm so glad we don't have to deal with, like, this old hardware anymore that was not meant to be running for, like, 3 days straight 10 years after it was made. But yeah, it's a really fascinating game, and there's still glitches that are being turned up. Like, I think a couple years ago, someone found a bug that when you that lets you attack on, like, the very first frame of the fight, which is really big for a character like Magneto, who has very fast moves. So, like, the natural response to that becomes, like, okay, if they got Magneto on their team, you should probably start with someone like Sentinel, who has a hit of super armor, and therefore you can negate that. And, like, it layers upon itself. And that's just sort of the beauty of this game that I also don't enjoy playing very much, but it's so fun to watch.
I do think one of the great strengths of having it being re-released this year is you've seen, you know, with our current YouTube and streaming culture, I've seen an abundance of people coming out of the woodwork with tutorials and explainers And, you know, we mentioned Justin Wong before. Justin Wong is playing this game so much that Steam reviews mention him by name. You know, there are people who bought this game on Steam, discovered that he was in there. It's Wazzler, right?
Wazzler. Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, they got their ass beat. And they're like, I'm refunding this game. This game is too hard. But, it's like, obviously that stings if you're the player. But if you go online and, like, just watch him on Twitch or YouTube, whatever, he is constantly showing off all kinds of stuff. He's trying new, you know, as John mentioned, he tries new teams all the time. You know, because he's so good at the game in general, he can try, like, you know, two characters he knows well and one character he doesn't even know at all. And he'll figure it out live on camera. It's like, okay, what works? What doesn't work? You know,
yeah, maybe... He'll let the crowd give him a team, like, what, Iceman, Sentinel, and, like, Omega Red? Fuck it, let's go. And then he'll just, yeah, you're right, he'll figure it out on the fly. It's great. And he's been doing that since before this re-release. He was trying
to,
like, this was sort of up and running fairly well on Fightcade within the last couple of years, maybe a year or two, but still not arcade perfect. And, you know, he'd get on there and he wouldn't really roll people in Fightcade, but he'd get in there and just muck with the game. And it's awesome to see people that have been playing this for that long still do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, this was the game that made him, like, a name in the fighting game scene. Yeah. I remember after it came out, and I was reading about the Shoryuken forums, and they just kept talking about, like, there's this kid in New York at Chinatown Fair. There's only, like, two people who can beat him. He whips everybody else. Oh, he's traveled out to some event in California or Chicago or whatever. He whipped everyone there, didn't lose to anyone. And that was Justin Wong. And that was sort of like, this is his game. I'm sure he would agree. Like, this is his jam, like, his go-to.
Yeah, and he was a literal kid at the time, too. Like, everybody else was in, like,
teenager,
their 20s, and he was, like, 15 or whatever. But, yeah, everybody knows, the lay fighting game person or video game observer knows Justin Wong from Evil Moment 37, but that is not how Justin is known in the old-timey fighting game community. Another really cool thing about this game, especially for observers and not players, is that because it's a 3-on-3 game, there's a handful of really good all-rounder characters on the roster. There are some real incredible comebacks that happen in this game. So, like, there's a real, I can't remember which Evo it was, but, like, there's some really bad, like, shaky handheld camera video of this, of, like, Justin getting just his face kicked in, and he was down to his Cyclops, who only had, like, maybe 2/3 or half of his life left, and his Cyclops took out all three of the other person's team. And that is basically his legend right there. Like, the guy just comes back, and this game allows for some really great viewing if that's the kind of stuff that you're into.
It's not necessary. I was going to say, you know, the actual action is great. I would not say the stages or the music are particularly befitting a game this fast paced and, like, high intensity.
Let's talk about that. Yeah, it's time to talk about that stuff, because this game, as was the time, as very popular at the time, you know, this is 2000. A lot of 2D fighting games were trying to figure out how can we incorporate 3D graphics, because so many people think 2D art is bad and 3D is, like, not just a future, but, like, the 3D is now and 2D is, like, the past, and we don't want the past. And so Marvel Capcom 2, obviously, you know, which is built on, like, a solid decade now of, you know, 2D art, you know, some fantastic 2D art. What they do is they have all these 2D characters fighting their 2D war, but all the backgrounds are entirely 3D. And I'm not sure I ever heard an explanation as to why, but, like, the backgrounds don't seem to mean anything. Or at least they're from somewhere else. Like, Marvel Capcom 1, every stage is, like, a delight of sort of, like, details you can pick up on. What's that over there? Who's that over there? Is that Dr. Wily? That's Dr. Wily. You know? Marvel Capcom 2, it's like, I'm looking at a clown. It's a very large clown. The clown moves his hands and opens his eyes. Now we're in a frozen wasteland, and it's very cold here.
There's a big clock. Oh, and look, it's based on the system clock of the Dreamcast. That's neat.
Yeah. So you get these graphics, which are, like, they're good graphics for the time. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. I didn't say, I looked at it, it's like, oh wow, look at these graphics. But it's like, eventually you're sort of like, well, what am I looking at here? Where are we? Like, what, you know, what universe is this? Because it's not Capcom universe, it's not Marvel universe. It doesn't feel like nothing, none of these stages look to me like anything.
The best I can give them is that there's a ship stage that I assume is Ruby Heart's pirate ship, and there's like a desert that I assume is a Mingo's. And beyond that, it's just have fun. Figure it out.
And in line with that, you have the music, which is from, what's the name? Sorry, John found the name. Tetsuya Shibata, who worked on Power Stone. And the music for Marvel Capcom 2 is not like any other music in any other video game at that point. And mostly since? Like, it is a hard swerve. And that doesn't mean bad, but at the time, and, you know, people talk to this, they're surprised, but no, at the time, when you make something that is so different than everything else, yeah, a lot of people are just going to say, what the hell is this? I didn't ask for this. I don't want this. Therefore, it is bad. And that was a very real reaction from a lot of people. I've said this before in the podcast. Say it again. Game Fan Magazine. Game Fan Magazine reviewed, you know, all these games all the time. They would break down each game. You know, they do like EGM style, but their breakdowns would include like graphics and sound, whatever. I don't know who the character was, but one of their characters, when they reviewed Marvel Capcom 2, when they talked about music, they didn't put a number. They just put an emoji angry face. That was their review of the music from Marvel Capcom 2. And like, you know, today it sounds good and people do covers. It's really nice. But wow, it really doesn't fit the vibe of we've got six superhumans throwing themselves at each other. They're exploding. Everything's on fire. But let's, you know, ooh, yeah. Woohoo. Like, it's just, it's incongruous. It's a
choice.
It is. It was incongruous. Choice. Yeah.
And the announcer was just as wacky. He just said, like, in the tone in his voice, oh my God, I just had a heart attack there. It's like Quiet Storm DJing. It's very weird, but fun. It's like, you're right. We love it now, and it's been memed to death. Even like in that proto-internet age of 2000, ooh, so long ago, like people were kind of clowning on this game and for its music and its sound. But like, I think because of that, because of the internet, even back then, it just became something that we all sort of slowly fell in love with over time.
It also resulted in a huge mod scene, we should say, because people so didn't like the music, they actually went out of their way to take the music out and play their own music, which also went hand in hand with custom colors, which is also a big thing that people don't really talk about as much today, because obviously consoles and always online internet, like, you know, a Steam game, of course, Steam games all have mods on them, but, you know, if you buy a PlayStation 5 game, instead of reverse compared to a PlayStation 1 game, like PlayStation 1 games, you could literally mod your console and mess with them. I don't know if you can do that with PlayStation 5 without violating some kind of warranty. That's, you know, and for an always online console, that's a problem. You know, that is a problem.
Yeah, I remember like back in the day, there was like whole threads about how do you mod this game and like people digging into the code of Marvel 2 and figuring out how is the music stored? What's the file type? How do you convert things to that file type? How do you make it loop properly? You know, where do they store the colors? So there's all sorts of like really fascinating mods out there. Like there's sort of a famous video on YouTube of, you know, Yipes back in his Marvel 2 days talking about like the Nyx version of Sentinel or the Mango Sentinel. And that's, that is a color mod. That is not in the game. They added it to, I think, Marvel 3.
Yeah.
As, like, a little Easter egg. But, you know, there's still, like, a group on Facebook of people who are still modding this game and, like, coming up with their own colors and everything. It's really fascinating. There was a Rolling Stones article, from a few years ago that talked a lot about this and, like, talked to some of the big fighting game people from then. And, like, Living La Vida Loca was a big song in one of the mixes. I have like a Wu-Tang Clan mix that's pretty sweet. God, what were some of the other, like Sandstorm from Darude? That was a huge one. Just all sorts of like really funky soundtracks that people were putting together. And I think that's like an easily overlooked part of this game's legacy because like you can't really stream with any of these, right? Because you'll just get a DMCA or they'll mute your stream and all that fun stuff. But like that offline scene back before streaming was a thing. They were all using these. They weren't using the default soundtrack. And I think it's It was like a bone they threw to him when this got a port in 2009 to Xbox Live and PSN, that they had an option for you to just like, okay, we'll like mute the game and let you just play whatever music you want. That was a neat little touch.
Yeah, the guy that tried to teach me this game for the first time, he had his modded to play the Transformers the movie soundtrack.
Ooh. I think I've heard that one before.
It fit. Everything fit really well.
That soundtrack kicks ass is what it does. That's the problem. That kicks ass. So you have a game with kick-ass soundtrack, it's going to work. Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That synth overture, do-do-dum, dum-do-do-dum, that kind of thing was playing over the character select screen, and I'm like, is this really in the game? Like, did they license this? And I didn't find out until a little later, but all the same, it fit pretty well.
Get Dare to be Stupid for the clown stage.
Happy birthday, Weird Al. You can be a coffee achiever, you can sit around the house and watch Leave It to Beaver. The future's up to you, so what you gonna do? Let's advance because we want to get to really two more games on this list. So let's advance to the far off year of 2011. So a full 11 years later, we get Marvel Capcom 3. And obviously in that time, you know, some business comes and goes. We have some ports. You know, we talked about it was kind of a surprise at the time, the 2009 online port of Marvel Capcom 2, which led to other ports. And I guess because they got the band back together, Marvel Capcom came together and said, all right, 2011, here we go. Marvel Capcom 3, Fate of Two Worlds, FTW. It's a big joke. You get it. Now, at this point, the arcades are a long memory. So this is designed and released for home systems, your PlayStation 3s, and your Xbox 360s. And again, this is post Street Fighter 4. So what kind of game is this? It's a 2D fighter, but now all the assets are in 3D. So all your fighters are basically 3D models, but, you know, fighting on a 2D plane. You know, they've got some outlines to them that are, you know, artistic, but basically it's, you know, it's very much like the Street Fighter 4 ethos, if you will. And we should also point out, but now 2011, at this point, the MCU has started and the MCU is, you know, it's doing okay. It's not quite the juggernaut, if you will, that it will be, because this is 2011 and Avengers arrives the following year, 2012. But by this point, you've already had Iron Man as a big hit. Iron Man 2 made a lot of money. Thor, I think 2011 is the year Captain America comes out. So the signs are there that something is brewing in cinemas and something's going to happen. So Marvel is looking, you know, Marvel's popular. Capcom is, you know, selling what it's selling. You know, obviously this comes on the heel of Street Fighter 4 and Resident Evil 5. Resident Evil 5 sold many copies. Do not forget that Resident Evil 5 sold many copies and for a long time was Capcom's number one game, like of all games. So, yeah, here they go. We got Marvel Capcom 3. And who's in Marvel Capcom 3? Well, surprise, surprise, three characters from Resident Evil 5. I'll do a lineup real quick, because it's a pretty big roster for a brand new game that is not working on any real, like, pre-existing assets. I guess some of these 3D models may have been in Street Fighter 4, but, like, most of these characters are new, and certainly all the backgrounds are new.
I think some of them came from Tatsunoko versus Capcom as well.
Well, that's also in development around the same time, right? 2011, so...
Thereabouts. Came out in, like, 2008, is that right?
Yeah, this was on the Resident Evil engine, I think.
Oh, was it?
I think that's what it was built on, was the RE5 engine. I could be wrong about that, but it wasn't built on the Street Fighter 4 engine.
Okay, I apologize for my error. Let me do the rundown real quick here. So we got Jill Valentine, Albert Wesker, Chris Redfield, Akuma, Tron Bonne, Zero, Crimson Viper, Chun-Li, Ryu, Trish and Dante, Amaterasu, Nathan Spencer, a.k.a. Bionic Commando, Beautiful Joe, Sienko, Morgan, Felicia, Arthur, Mike Hagar, yes, Mike Hagar from Final Fight. On the Marvel side, Dr. Doom, Dormammu, Shumagorath, Super Skrull, MODOK, Taskmaster, Captain America, Thor, Iron Man, Spider-Man, Storm, Wolverine, Deadpool, Magneto, X-23, this is definitely the first time I've ever heard X-23, Phoenix, Sentinel, Hulk, and She-Hulk.
Super Skrull's fun.
Yes. But one thing I think that I really enjoyed, that even for me as someone who at this point was very much a lapsed Marvel reader, I really enjoyed just sort of this overview of comic books. Like, oh, I've heard of them. I've never heard of them, but they look cool. And likewise, Capcom, with his own history, is like, some of these characters are really big, but other characters like Amaterasu and Beautiful Joe, like, those games did not sell very well. And certainly at that point were, you know, almost a decade old, or at least not a decade, but like, not really talked about much.
They were a few years old.
Yeah. They were not on the cusp of things like, say, Devil May Cry or Resident Evil were. So it's like, okay, here's characters that people might not recognize at first, but we love them, you know? Certainly Arthur, I mean, how long had it been since Arthur had been in a game? It'd been quite a while, you know, unless you count the PSP version, you know, of Ultimate Ghouls and Ghosts. You know, Mike Hagar, Final Fight, that was definitely a pull and led to so many wonderful fan arts of him delivering a suplex to the final boss, who we'll get to. You know, just wonderful artwork out there. But I think, like, as a general, like, roster, I think a lot of people were kind of impressed. That's how I felt. Like, cool. And certainly it came out in an era, you know, at this point in, you know, social media was a huge thing. So if you launched a fighting game, you didn't just launch a fighting game. What happened was you introduced a fighting game and you reveal, like, I don't know, four characters. And then over the next year, you slowly tease out two or three characters at a time so that you're always dominating the news cycle of here's a new character, here's a new character, here's a new character. And I feel like today we've kind of exhausted this. Like, people are like, no, really, just tell us who's in the game. But it was a thing. It was definitely a thing. So right around this time, you know, I was going to TGS a lot. I was already writing about video games. You know, whenever I went to TGS, I could expect a new character trailer, you know, new something, maybe a new playable character. And it's just that's just how it went.
Yeah, some of these were really interesting, like how they adapted them. I know, it's like, Sea Viper, they actually, did they do this for Ultimate? Or was it in this one where they gave her the Optic Blast from Cyclops as like a move?
Oh, I don't know. I think that's in Ultimate. I don't remember. I'm sorry.
That was like a really cool like idea. They're like, oh, she has red glasses. Cyclops has red glasses. He's not in the game. Let's give it to her. Or Super Skrull. If I remember reading when this game came out, Marvel wanted all the Fantastic Four in this, and Capcom's like, well, that's four characters. What if we just combine all their powers and just run Super Skrull? Mm-hmm. And Capcom was like, Marvel was like, eh, that's fine. So we got Super Skrull, who is super cool and also a very weird like pick in isolation. Yeah, Phoenix was a really interesting adaptation, how they like, brought in that character. And voiced by Jennifer Hale, who
yes.
now voices the character on X-Men 97, which is a very weird reversal of how things went in the last episode of Marvel Games.
Well, she is Canadian, so it was bound to happen.
Yeah, so it's a really cool lineup. I really had no complaints about it.
Yeah, like, I really like some of the choices that they made on the Marvel side specifically. Like, I think Deadpool was such a big hit from the comics reading community that he was sort of a shoe-in, and Thor was really in the middle of a really good reboot at that point. That, like, they used his redesign outfit, and I think he played really interestingly, big, slow, sort of project, still shooting projectiles and stuff. But yeah, really good cast, really beginner friendly game. It didn't move really as fast, I think, as Marvel 2.
At least not yet.
Not yet, right.
Right.
And it also sort of, you know, restructured the button layout of the game too, so you're not really dealing with you're still sort of messing with six buttons, but not quite to the degree that Marvel 2 was. So it was just like a low, medium, high punch, assists, and a launcher button, and or a special button that was largely a launcher for most people. And that was pretty, I think, easy for people to really wrap their head around. But yeah. really great cast, still 3-on-3, saddled with some weirdness because, like, and we're going to get to this in a second too, but, like, its own sequel came out so quickly afterward, but, like, the competitive scene to this really latched onto it pretty quickly from what I remember. Like, they were, you know, we're 2 years removed from the home console version of Street Fighter 4, so people were really ready sort of for that next big thing, and this was kind of it.
Had a lot of like single player content too, which I think people really appreciated, and the sequel really didn't favor as heavily as the original release did. Do you want to talk about that real quick?
Well, I wanted to mention just quickly another thing, because this is a console game, and certainly given the era it came out in, DLC is a big part of this game.
Yes.
Right at the top, I mentioned Jill Valentine and Shuma Gorath. Those characters are not in the base game. Those cost extra. Even in the sequel, if you want those two characters, you have to pay for them. The modern ports unlock this by default. But at the time, if you saw the roster and you saw those two characters, you're like, oh, I want those characters. Well, you got to pay extra for those. Also, because every character is a 3D model, this opens up a lot more options as far as costume choices. Like, you know, in the 2D era, it's like, okay, you want to change the costume? Well, we can change the colors. That's what we can give you. You know, best I can do. But now it's all 3D models, so some characters have entirely alternate costumes, not just alternate colors, which means you get stuff like Spider-Man has, like, the Scarlet Spider vest on him, you know? Or, what's a good example?
They were usually based on, like, what had been going on in the comics. Like, I know Hulk had a Red Hulk.
Mm-hmm, sure.
God, now I'm blanking. It's been so long since I've really messed with them. I know Spider-Man had the Iron Spider from Civil War.
The different Wolverine outfits over the years, that's kind of a layup.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, some of them were just like alternate outfits that they used to have. I remember Spencer has the NES Bionic Commando look, because, you know, Bionic Commando Rearmed had come out around this time. And his default was based on the 3D game that has been fairly maligned since then, but... he's a much cooler character when he looks like a nerd from the 80s.
Right.
I think we can all agree.
But some of these characters, some of these skins, unfortunately, were purchasable. You had to buy them. Like, the game came with, you know, the game, obviously you can't all play the same character, so the game has some alternate skins in it. But a lot of them, such as the Bionic Commando one, you had to pay for them.
Yeah.
Which I know for me was definitely a sore point. Like, oh man, I don't want to pay for a cosmetic. Like, that to me was like... I can, like, a new character, I'll consider it. But you want me to buy a new costume? I do not want to buy a costume. I'm sorry.
And remember, they had to cut out Magneto's alternate costume, because it's on the disc, because all the DLC is on the disc. But he had his House of M outfit, which caused a bit of a issue, because it's literally just the clothes that the King of Spain, like, wears, like, as his official outfit. And I guess the Spanish were not thrilled about this. Being on Magneto, so Capcom had to just never release like the code to let you like actually use them.
But the data's there.
The game,
but, yeah. Like, so people found a way to unlock it, and of course, you know, today if you play it on Steam, you can just download it. It's fine. But it is funny how they announced the costume, and the nation of Spain said, "Now wait a second,
hang on."
Yeah, it was announced like they promoted it, and then it just never happened.
Well, you just brought up something that's really interesting about this game, and more so, Street Fighter Cross Tekken. But, like, this DLC was mostly finished on the disc if you bought the game on a disc, right?
Yep.
So there is a playable but not 100% finished version of Jill Valentine, for example. So this was definitely... We're still sort of in the Wild West of DLC. Like, how much are we charging for things? What are people actually going to pay for? And so this was part of a larger discussion of, like, what do you own? So if I buy this disc, I should already own Jill Valentine. I shouldn't have to pay for the DLC because the data is on the disc that I bought. And so this was a major topic of discussion all around the games industry for at least a few months. And then Street Fighter Cross Tekken really kind of did this in a much worse way, because there was a ton of characters and extra stuff that was on the disc. And all you're really doing is paying to unlock them from something that if you bought it physically, you already physically own. So there was a lot of kind of like ethical navel-gazing and lots of think pieces in the games press about this. But it was a really interesting time for DLC, and Capcom learned some tough lessons out of this game, we'll say, and that maybe we shouldn't leave half-finished characters out there for people to just data mine for themselves. But on the flip side, like years into the future, the modding scene for this game, especially on Steam, is just absolutely bonkers. And like people have sort of latched onto it and have been adding a bunch of new characters over the years, like Gambit, like Cyclops and stuff like that. I haven't really checked in for a while, but a lot of this stuff is perfectly playable even online. And people are running tournaments with like new versions of essentially this entire game, which is pretty awesome. I mean, even if you're really not into the game very much, like, you know, just do a little bit of digging and you can see a lot of footage of very cool stuff that people have just done in their spare time.
Yeah, and I know this game is sort of a love it or hate it, and maybe both a situation because of like two of the new mechanics. So the one is the, like a team aerial combo where you, while you're doing an air combo, you can push a direction, and I think it's the special button, and you will launch your opponent in one of the directions, and your next character will come in to continue the combo. Which can lead to a bunch of infinites, but they can counter that if they push like the same direction that you did when you do it, and they'll like sort of push you out, and then they can, you know, do their thing. And that one, like, people sort of accepted the infinites coming off of it. Not great, but whatever. It's the other mechanic, the X factor, that is, right, I feel, much more divisive. So this is a, I think you push all four attack buttons at the same time, once per match, and your characters will get a boost to like speed and strength. And depending on how many characters you have, depends on how long it is and how much faster and stronger you get. And this kind of like breaks the game.
I think your point character also heals their red health too.
Yes. They all heal up faster, and yeah, your point character will heal up while fighting as well. So like, you suddenly have this situation where you can make you can not only make a comeback, but you could absolutely like decimate the other person if you've got like the advantage, because you can combo into these X factors. Like, you can just cancel whatever you're doing into it. So like, if you're on offense and you're destroying your opponent's team, you can X factor, just completely wipe out whichever character, and then, you know, start the incoming mix like in Marvel 2. So yeah, this is always the thing that I hear people who play Marvel 3 like, oh, I love this game, I hate X Factor, or I love X Factor because I'm the one who just won with it. You know, that sort of thing.
I feel a lot of the old timey fighting game people really, really despise this game. Like the Marvel 2 diehards that have been like basically keeping the lights on in the US didn't really glom onto this, but like, you know, Justin, not to keep bringing him up, he was an early champion of this game. I mean, not just like from a competitive standpoint, but like, no, this is good. And it's not like it's just a bunch of new Capcom staff that's making this stuff. The guy that basically built Third Strike, Neo G, he worked on this game. These guys aren't messing around. So it had a really weird early reputation in fighting game circles that has sort of gotten much brighter over time, especially after the next couple of games that came out. But it's still sort of it feels like it's kind of a footnote anymore, like especially with the re-release of Marvel 2 that just happened. I don't really know how big of a scene this still really has, but it was an Evo retro game, what, last year or 2 years ago?
I think it was last year, 2023. No, it was I feel like there's still a scene for this, because the netcode is just like the 2011 netcode and therefore not great. I think they use, like different software, like, Parsec to actually run it. But yeah, it's got a scene. They play it pretty regularly.
Yeah.
I do want to move on to the sequel, because it's a very big part of this talk of this game. But I do also want to mention the fact that after Marvel Capcom 2 had a boss so forgettable that we basically skipped him, a guy called Abyss, who does not exist. The Capcom made him up, Abyss. It's basically like Onslaught, but bigger. In this game, like, no. We wanna have something that matters to people. So they bring in Galactus. Galactus is the boss of Mortal Capcom 3, and Galactus the guy, not Galactus the Cloud, 20th Century Fox. It is Galactus as a guy wearing a big goofy helmet, and he is so big, he doesn't fit on the screen. And I do love the whole sequence in that you're fighting him in front of the planet on, like, this asteroid. You're basically, like, bumping his chest because that's all you can really get on the screen with him. Like, that's how giant he is. And you fight a team. First, you fight a team of his heralds, which is just a silver-colored team, which is, like, that's funny. They're all silver. I get it. And then you fight Galactus himself, and he, of course, is a big lumbering beast with giant moves. And, you know, if you hit him right, you can do enough damage and win the day. But if you screw up, he will just KO you, and it's game over, and then you get this, unfortunately, unskippable cutscene where he destroys the Earth, which, to me, as a player, I was like, come on, I just want to try again. Just let me try again? No, I have to watch this again? Okay, sorry. Sorry, Earth.
Yeah, and I remember this came with, like, a little comic book setting up, like, the premise of the game, which was a nice touch, like a physical comic book.
Yeah, all the dialogue, I feel like, in the game, they really went the extra mile. Like, again, after Mortal Capcom 2 basically took place nowhere and no one knew anything, and you all get, like, the generic endings, Marvel Capcom 3 said, okay, no, we've got pre-fight banter, we have characters saying things to other characters, like Tony, you know, Iron Man Tony Stark will flirt with ladies. I know there's a thing where if you have him and he fights Bionic Commando, he's like, what, you couldn't afford the rest of the suit? Like, he's mocking him because he only got one arm? Like, that's funny. Deadpool, of course, Deadpool's got 1,000 lines in this game. You know, his super involves beating his opponent with the actual super bar. He pulls the super bar off the screen and beats you with it like a bat. Like, that's hilarious. So,
and it's not something you could have done with the sprites either. Like, no. Exactly. They were taking advantage of the 3D graphics.
Like, to me, that kind of stuff was really a good return to what made Marvel Capcom 1 so much fun. Like, here we are, we're embracing all these characters. And again, you have 3D stages, of course, but now the 3D stages are actually based on Marvel ideas or Capcom ideas. Like, I know there's a whole, like, Ghouls and Ghosts stage. There's a whole, like, you know, New York City stage with spider webs in the background. Like, all these stages mean something to somebody, and it makes the game all the more endearing. Which is why it drove me crazy that 9 months later, the same calendar year, Capcom says, here is Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3, our brand new game. What do you mean we released this game already? No, this is a brand new game with more characters than ever before. It's the same systems, plus it's a launch. It's a Vita launch title. And if you buy the Vita version and you own the PS3 version, they'll connect. You can connect them. You can play on your Vita like you're playing on the screen and, you know, touch screen. You know, very, very nice features. And yeah, we've talked about this before. We mentioned this in our fighting game doldrums episode. But, like, yeah, Capcom insists that the idea was they were going to release Marvel Capcom 3 and then release DLC and add more characters to the game. Because they already had, you know, it launches with two characters, Sue Megorath and Jill Valentine. They wanted to launch more DLC characters. But somehow, the horrific disaster of of March 2011 reorganized their finances. I mean, I know the Japanese economy certainly went through some changes. I know this because I lived here. I bought a house. But still, somehow this convinced Capcom to abandon the DLC plan. And I mean abandon it. Not just like, oh, we'll release, like, you know, a champion edition that has new stuff in it. Like, no. The only way to get the new characters is to buy the new game. There is no DLC plan for the new characters. You must buy a new game.
There's no upgrade path like they did with Street Fighter 4 either.
Right. And, like, you know, when Street Fighter 4 came out and they had they released a new version a couple years later, at least at that point they said, oh, we didn't know it would be such a big hit. No. You knew this was coming, but somehow this was the best solution. Yeah. This was the best solution. Second game in one calendar year. And it does a lot. They add a lot of characters, and they revamp, they rebalance a lot of characters. They change how the X-Factor system works. You can do it in the air now. It's more visually distinct when you have X-Factor, when you don't have X-Factor. I mean, just the new characters real quickly. Doctor Strange, Firebrand, Frank West, Ghost Rider, Hawkeye, Iron Fist, that's a miss, Nemesis, Nova, Phoenix Wright?
Phoenix Wright was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rocket Raccoon, there's Strider Hiryu is back, and we needed a third Devil May Cry character, here's Virgil. That's a lot of characters.
Yeah, and Phoenix Wright was really interesting, because like he was intended to be in Tatsunoko versus Capcom in 2008, and the dev team at that point abandoned the plan because they couldn't figure out how they would implement like a visual novel character into that game. So here they finally like sorted that out. They're like, oh, this is what he'll do. He'll like look for clues, and that'll power him up once he finds them all. And he can have the judge attack, and Maya can help. And it's very cute. Like, these are all great like versions of these characters, except Iron Fist, because he's Iron Fist.
Yep.
But you know, the fact that you had to pay like, was it $40 at launch or something? Yeah. Yeah. For a brand new disc for a game that came out earlier that year, it's a real kick in the teeth.
Yeah, tournament organizing friends of mine were really upset about this. Like, really, really upset about this. And so I think that they bought a couple of copies. So at this point, I was going to this huge weekly that was at a chain restaurant in the Cleveland area. And like, we'd have huge crowds, 50, 60 guys showing up plus every week. It was great. The staff hated us because most of those jerks didn't tip. But like, the guys putting this on from week to week, they were so miffed by this. We're like, we're buying one copy of Ultimate Marvel. If people are into it, start bringing your own copies. And that's it. And because, you know, these guys are buying all the DLC. They're buying all the games. They're, you know, they're really putting a lot of their own money on the line. I remember, yeah, there was a lot of rancor in at least my local community about a re-release so close after the original game. And that it added so much, and that, like, if you want to play this, you have to play this new version. So you spend $100 that year, not even on DLC, on just two copies of basically the same game.
Yeah, at least the DLC carries over. If, like, you already bought it for Marvel 3, like, it works for Ultimate Marvel. So it's, that almost takes the sting out, but not really, because, again, it's full price for an upgrade. Something that would now just be like, oh, here's Season 2 of Marvel 3. But, of course, that concept didn't really exist yet, so.
Yep.
Also, this is the game that unlocks Galactus mode. So if you beat the game, you can play basically a single-player version of Galactus fighting CPU teams, and it's just, you know, let's drive the big guy around for a while. That's just a fun little extra, which, and they said in interviews that was inspired by so many, you know, fan-made hacks of earlier games that let you play as bosses that normally you couldn't play as, you know? So why not play as Galactus? Obviously, there's no tournament. You can't main Galactus, but it's a fun mode there. It's a single player game. Why not?
We've kind of danced around Tatsunoko versus Capcom a few times in this conversation, but that game did have characters like, not quite to the scale of Galactus, but it had a few huge characters on the roster.
Yes. Yes.
So that sort of did, that was kind of the precedent there too. But even those guys, I don't think are tournament legal. I don't. From what
they are, because you can counterplay them.
Okay.
But, I think some tournaments don't allow them, but I think generally, like, yeah, you can pick them. It's just characters like Tekkaman completely demolish them.
Oh, okay. But yeah, the precedent was there, and it's cool that they kind of threw that into this. I mean, it's just another, I don't know. You think, do we want to call this a bone to the fans for making them pay an extra $40? I don't know.
It's the best. Not much. It's the least they could do.
It is the least they could do. Yeah.
I feel like a lot of the hatred of this practice has sort of faded over the years because time heals all wounds. But some of us still remember. And I'm sure all the game stores that have to sell like vanilla versions of Marvel 3 sure remember.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could probably go into a record exchange right now and buy vanilla Marvel 3 for PS3 for like $4 or something. Like,
yeah.
Everybody just got rid of it so they could upgrade to this if they were going to play it. Everything's just as online as it is right now. This practice, it's never going to happen again. And that's I'm glad that we've learned from Capcom's mistakes, I suppose.
Well, you know, it is still playable. It got re-released on the PS4 and the Xbox and the Steam platforms, like back in 2016, 2017, and they're all still up. So I guess whatever new agreement Capcom came to with Marvel has let them keep this one for sale. Hopefully for a very long time.
Yes, because it's available a la carte, this one is not included in the recent Marvel Capcom Fighting Game Collection, which means it's not on Switch. So if you buy the collection for Switch, you can play all these classic games up to and including 2, but you can't play 3. 3 is only available on the home consoles and Steam. But it regularly goes on sale, so honestly, at this point, just, you know, you've probably just
wait a little bit.
Yeah. And with that note, we're getting close to 2 hours, so we should wrap things up. There is one more Marvel Capcom game, but it's not retro. And frankly, it is a huge discussion to talk about what the hell happened. So we'll sidestep that one for a future episode, perhaps in 2027 when it turns 10 years old. I don't know. But wrapping things up here, I think Marvel Capcom as a series, for me, it was just like, I viewed it as a celebration. You know, I really enjoyed the preceding games. When I saw Marvel Capcom 1, I was like, oh, this is really cool. Yes, great. When I saw Marvel Capcom 2, I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. Even if a lot of my friends at the time, you know, much like you, John and Kevin, were kind of like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I'm into this. So I kind of had to play it by myself, which was not the fun way to play it because I didn't have anyone to like experiment with. But still, it was hugely appealing to me. And as we said, these games had very long tails, especially because, you know, right after Marvel Capcom 2 comes out, there's almost a decade of very few high-profile fighting game releases, and so people kept going back to Marvel Capcom 2 because it was still there and people still loved it. And it probably got even bigger over time because it was like a go-to staple. Like, oh, we still have this. We're still playing this. We're still going to it. And then you have 3. 3 arrives, and at first I think there's a very initial positive boom. Some people don't like it, but most people are into it. And then Capcom kind of kneecaps himself the same year with just another version. And yeah, I don't know. Today, I feel like the re-releases, I feel like are a real positive. Certainly, it's been a huge influx of warm reception, new fans, people making new material to say, hey, here's how you play this game. Here's things you can do. Go online. Obviously, the new versions are all online. You can play them online. But Marvel and Capcom today are very different than the Marvel Capcom from even 10 years ago. So what do we think now? Is there a 4? What would 4 look like?
Well, they skipped over Infinite for this conversation, and that's probably for the best. But I feel like it would not look like that, certainly. Because Marvel 3, like, it did get dinged with the Ultimate debacle, but I think it's had a pretty good tail itself. Like, people were playing it pretty consistently and with pretty strong numbers right up until Infinite came out, and then, you know, Infinite was the new game and that kind of dinged the whole series. But I feel like since, you know, that game, you know, bombed, folks have gone back to 3 in smaller numbers, and like they've kept it alive. They kept it alive well enough to give it another slot at Evo, which that was cool to see. It's cool to see how the game has sort of developed over time. And I'm sure Marvel 2 will be coming at Evo probably next year now that there's a new way to play it. But, yeah, I think whatever they do next, if they do another one, will probably look more like 2 and 3 with, like, the 3 versus 3 teams and all the wacky assists and the very... I think they will probably go with 3's very, like... what's the word I'm looking for? Very in keeping with, like, the themes of Marvel and Capcom, like the stages and the music that you'd see, you know, that call back to the characters, as opposed to 2 and Infinite, which are just sort of generic slop. But yeah, I do think a Marvel 4 could happen. They worked well enough together to get this new collection out, and as we know, Capcom, if they make enough money off of something, they'll find some other way to make more money off it. So if they're happy enough with how this collection's done, maybe we'll see a 4.
I think Marvel and Capcom had a pretty icy relationship after Marvel vs. Capcom 2, in that, like, it felt like a really big deal when Marvel 2 got re-released for the PlayStation 3 and 360. And, you know, a fair amount of people bought it. I think there was still that high from Street Fighter 4 that people were on. I bought it so I could sort of vote for my wallet to get a re-release of Third Strike. But then again, after that, it was kind of nothing until Marvel vs. Capcom 3. And then, you know, what we were talking about earlier, there was a real power dynamic shift when especially Marvel Infinite came out, and that Marvel was definitely calling the shots with how that game went down. And I think that everyone is sort of in a better place now. And, you know, we're certainly seeing, or we're sitting in the middle of yet another Capcom test, as we keep saying. Is this re-release just came out. It seems to have sold pretty well. There's a whole lot of goodwill online for this thing. A lot of content creators, like old and new, are making a lot of content for Marvel 2 and Marvel 1, which is kind of great. So I think it's really just a matter of time before we see a Marvel 4. I really think it's going to happen. And I really think they will call it Marvel vs. Capcom 4. I think they're just going to keep sweeping Infinite under the rug. I'm loath to speculate what it's really going to look like, because all I keep going back to in my head is it's just going to be an extension of how Marvel vs. Capcom 3 had played, with just a different art style. Maybe back to 2-on-2. I doubt it, but I think that they're going to go back to 3-on-3. And I think, you know, they struck gold really with how Marvel 2 was built and how people were so into just not only playing it at super high level, but playing it at low level, just getting together with their friends and smashing buttons. And then just, you know, digging into the game, figuring out that everyone's cool to play. It's just, you know, even super competitively, you can play with almost anybody. So I think that they're going to want to do something like that. But everyone wants to know what a cast is going to be, right? So, like, you know, that's another reason I don't want to speculate about this. Because, like, in what kind of good state is everybody in? Now they own 20th Century Fox. So, yes, they can put X-Men characters back in those games. But what kind of Marvel or Capcom characters are we going to see? Like, what kind of deep cuts are going to be there? That's the stuff that everybody wants to know. So, yeah, I think it's going to play like Marvel 2 and or Marvel 3, but I think it's just going to have sort of a blander cast. But I think it's going to happen. It's only a matter of time.
Who knows? Even Infinite had Jedha.
There, right.
That was there a deep cut.
Mm-hmm. At that point, definitely.
Just for reference, I looked it up on SteamDB right now. So at this point, as we speak, Ultimate Marvel Capcom 3 has a 24-hour peak of 171 players. Compare that to the new hotness, of course, the fighting game collection. Double that, 342.
Yeah.
So there's still an audience out there. There's people are still, you know, 171 active players at any given time is pretty good, I think, considering how many people have Steam. But obviously, the collection's got a lot more attention on it right now. It's newer. It's hyper. It's an all-time peak of 6,000, which is way higher than anything Ultimate Marvel Capcom 3 ever got. So,
and that's way higher than the other Capcom re-release stuff. So, like, the first fighting game collection with all those Darkstalkers games, I don't think that they had that many concurrent players. People jump ship from the Street Fighter Anniversary Collection to play on Fightcade for games like Third Strike and the old, like, Super Turbo and stuff like that. So, to have that many concurrent players for Ultimate Marvel 3 is, that's saying something. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're all here for the Punisher.
Why wouldn't they be?
You said it, John. The all-time peak for Capcom Fighting Collection on Steam, 828.
Ugh.
So that's peanuts compared to the numbers we just shared. So, yeah. I guess Darkstalkers is still dead, but Marvel Capcom 4, it could happen. And they'll put Darkstalkers in there. Morgan will show up.
Uh-huh.
Maybe Anacharis will come back. I got fingers crossed. Anyway, 2 hours. That's been Retronauts. Thank you so much for joining us. If you're listening to this episode for free, guess what? Today's my birthday. Thank you very much.
Woo!
That's when this episode was up on my birthday. Thank you very much. And thank you for listening. However, if you go to patreon.com/retronauts, you could have heard this episode a week early when I was a week younger. You would have heard a fresher version of me. $3 a month gets you episodes 1 week early, higher bitrate and quality, audio quality, that is. the episodes are still the same quality because we make great episodes. But for $5 a month, just $2 more than the numbers I said, guess what? $5 a month gets you exclusive episodes every month. 2 episodes, 3 if we have more Fridays. You get Discord access where we're talking about all sorts of games all the time, including fighting games. You get weekly columns from me, and I read them to you. And I've absolutely talked about Marvel Capcom 2 and Marvel Capcom 3 and lots of other fighting games in there. If you like fighting games, go ahead. I like fighting games too. Let me tell you how much I love the fighting games. $5 a month. It's great. So please join us at patreon.com/retronauts. Otherwise, even if you listen for free, we really appreciate it because we have so much fun talking about old games. And thank you, Capcom, if you're listening. Thank you for bringing back these old games. We're really excited about the SNK Capcom fighting games, which come out sometime in 2025. Question mark. You know, gonna be awesome. I'm sure we'll have another episode about that because, hey, Capcom SNK is a whole other series. That's a brand new conversation.
The best series.
Anyway, Kevin.
Shots fired.
Kevin, please tell the people where they can find you on the internet if you want that.
You can find me on Blue Sky at Ubersaurus, and I also run Atari Archive, the YouTube video series and associated Patreon under the name Atari Archive. That's sort of discussing the history of early video games through the lens of the Atari 2600 library in chronological order of release. So I'm up to 82. Good times right there, let me tell you. Beyond that, I have a book, Atari Archive Volume 1. You can buy it through Limited Run and Amazon. Please check it out.
That's you, John.
Hi, I'm John again. You can find me at Blue Sky at John Learned. Not a lot of writing really anymore, but I'm still making video series on YouTube. I've, by the time this episode goes live, the final episode of the annotated Ninja Gaiden, NES Ninja Gaiden, should be complete and for your viewing pleasure. You can find that if just by doing a search for me on YouTube or just annotated games, you'll find all the other fun stuff. Go look at it. It's the best. It's the greatest.
Annotated Marvel?
Desk, yes. YouTuber Desk, we've mentioned him before. He did basically annotated game, what I do for Marvel Super Heroes versus Street Fighter, and like succinctly into 2 videos, and it's phenomenal to watch. So go check those out too.
All right. As for me, your host, Diamond Fight, you can find me on the internet by looking for my website, which is fightclub.me. F-E-I-T, that's my last name. C-L-U-B, that's a organization where people might play fighting games against each other. .me, Fight Club is me. You get it? And as we go out, I will just say, in the late, great Stan Lee's words, Excelsior! Good night!